Good morning. Good morning. I'm Joe Steinfield, your moderator for today, and I am pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Today's guest speaker, Heather Cox Richardson, will discuss what history can tell us about the present. First, thanks to Jose Lascano for providing the music that many of you enjoyed while waiting for today's broadcast to begin. And thank you also to Rivermead for sponsoring today's event. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. Donations can be made by mail on the Lyceum's website or by mail. And during this challenging year, of course, the Lyceum appreciates your help more than ever. Today's talk is being recorded and it will be available as a podcast, also on the Lyceum's website, and it will be rebroadcast on WUML 91.5 next Wednesday at 10:30 in the morning and next Sunday at 3 p.m. and also on WSMN 95.3 next Sunday at 7 in the morning and at 4 in the afternoon. After her presentation today, Ms. Richardson will be happy to answer your questions, which you can submit by using the live comments section on Facebook or on YouTube, or if you prefer, you can email them. The email address is monlyceum, all one word, monlyceum@gmail.com. After the program, your feedback will be most welcome, along with any suggestions for future speakers. Our speaker today was born and grew up in Maine. She attended Phillips Exeter and graduated from Harvard not once but twice, once with a BA and once with a PhD. She is currently a professor of history at Boston College, and she is a prolific author. Her latest book is called How the South Won the Civil War: Oligarchy, Democracy, and the Continuing Fight for the Soul of America. It's fitting that she should be speaking to us just days after the 4th of July, since all of her writings deal one way or another with our nation's continuing struggle with the founders' vision that all men are created equal. Her book, How the South Won the Civil War, isn't just about the war between the states. It is also about the thread between the Confederacy and the westward movement. And she explains in the book the linkage that created, as she puts it, a world defined by hierarchies in which equality depended on racial inequality. Professor Richardson's early morning newsletter, Letters from an American, which many of us look forward to every morning, blends three important ingredients: knowledge, perspective, and realism. Last week, Forbes magazine released its first ever 50 over 50, a list of women who are having a lasting impact on the world. She is on that list. She's become, in the words of the New York Times, a breakout star in the crowded world of online newsletters, and she has a very large following on Facebook and on Twitter. And on those rare occasions when either correcting papers or too little sleep keeps her from writing her column, she sends us beautiful photographs taken by her friend Buddy Poland. It's my great pleasure to introduce Heather Cox Richardson.
Thank you, Joe, and it's very much a pleasure to be here. I have to start by saying that I was actually in New Hampshire 40 years ago on this date, and I know that because today is my brother and sister-in-law's 40th wedding anniversary, and we were intending to be celebrating it after I did this live in New Hampshire, and of course, the pandemic put paid to that, but I'd like to wish them a happy anniversary. And I think probably after 40 years, they're probably getting pretty serious about each other. In any case, the title here for this talk was supposed to be what the past can tell us about the present. And of course, there's any number of ways one could go with that invitation. And in fact, I did do an entire write an entire lecture along those lines, sort of comparing the pre-Civil War years to the present and telling cool stories. And then I woke up this morning and I thought, you know, that's pretty obvious in a lot of ways. And there's something that is much more current right now that is not really getting the attention that I think it should. And that is voting rights. And now before you say, oh, I don't think it's, yeah, of course it's getting the attention it should. Let me tell you where I'm going with this. I'd like to talk about why voting rights are important to democracy, not simply to the Democrats in this moment or to America in general, what they really mean for self-representation. So let's start with why I think that this is an important idea to experiment with today. And that is, of course, because since the 2020 election, 43 states have introduced new legislation to suppress the vote, essentially. And between January 1st and May 14th of 2021, at least 14 states have in fact gone ahead and enacted 22 new laws that restrict access to the vote. At the same time, there are more laws in, as I say, in 43 states that are at least being discussed in 43 states that are going to curtail the vote, in addition to those ones that have already passed. And at the same time, what's going on in the states and is maybe not getting the attention that it should is that there have been really quite extraordinary levels of violence and violent threats against election officials. To the point that a series of interviews done by the Brennan Center, which is really kind of our gold standard for studying voting laws, and the Benenson Strategy Group in the spring found that one out of every three election officials in this country feels unsafe because of what they do for a living. And nearly one in five of them said that they had had threats to their lives since the November 2020 election. And it's worth remembering, of course, that these are our neighbors. The people who manage our elections are our friends and they are our neighbors. And they are doing, it's not an easy job. The other studies suggest that the work that is on election officials is really higher than it is on people similarly situated in the economy. They've got a lot of work on their plates. And now, for simply doing their jobs, they're getting death threats. So in addition to that, they say that about 78% of the election officials who are interviewed say that disinformation campaigns on social media not only make it more difficult for them to do their jobs, they also say 54% of them say that disinformation has made their jobs more dangerous. So with that backdrop, last week, as you probably know, the Supreme Court handed down a decision in Brnovich versus the DNC. And this is really important. It's about a couple of laws that Arizona passed in 2016. And with those laws in 2016, Arizona said, first of all, that if you voted in the wrong precinct, your ballot could be thrown out. And second of all, that there was only a certain number of people who could deliver an early ballot to a polling place. That would be a caregiver, a family member. You know, there's a very small category of people who can actually deliver an early ballot. Now, why do those matter? They matter because Arizona has a history of moving your precinct. So you might show up at a precinct where you'd voted in the past, but now you are no longer supposed to vote there. And if you cast your ballot at the place you used to cast it, now it's going to be thrown out. It also matters because if you think about the history of Arizona, in Arizona in the 2020 election, what appears to have tipped the vote for President Joe Biden was the vote among the Navajo Nation, which went over 90% in favor of Biden and Kamala Harris. And they are, of course, very isolated in Arizona. And what the new law means is that nobody can go around and pick up early ballots from members, for example, of the Navajo Nation or elderly or whatever, and pull them together and deliver them to a polling place. In fact, you're going to have to go in yourself or have a family member or caregiver go ahead and turn those in. And the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, said that that was okay. And that 6-3 vote, of course, is the six members of the court who have been appointed by Republicans and who hold now the majority, thanks to Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, who were all appointed by Donald Trump. And in his decision, Justice Samuel Alito wrote, And I quote, "The mere fact that there is some disparity in impact does not necessarily mean that a system is not equally open or that it does not give everyone an equal opportunity to vote." So even if the law means that some people are going to find it harder to vote, that doesn't mean that it's unconstitutional. All right. So this decision does a couple of things. First of all, obviously, it's going to constrict who gets to vote, but it also gives credence to the idea that it's reasonable to go ahead and restrict voting based on the idea of voter fraud. And I'm going to explain in just a second that voter fraud in America is virtually non-existent, and that this is something that has been whipped up since 1986 on the part of the current day Republican Party. And as you probably know, if you follow my work, I do like to make a distinction between where the Republican Party is today and where it was historically. The modern day Republicans, I won't call them conservatives because I think they're dangerous radicals, and that they have taken power in the Republican Party since the 1980s, the people who are now in control of it. Don't have time to go into that history, but I've talked about it a lot elsewhere. In any case, the reason that this interests me today and the reason I think it explains to some degree what the past can tell us about the present is this is not new in America. We have had a very similar movement in America, and we know exactly where it leads to. So let me go ahead and explain a little bit about the other period in our history that looked like this. And this is, of course, the period after the American Civil War. So during the American Civil War, two really important things happened, aside from, you know, the war and all that. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to get into that. But in terms of our politics, two very important things happened. First of all, the Republican Party that is in charge of Congress, the United States Congress, goes ahead and it redefines what it means to be an American and who can be an American. So before the war, ideal American citizens were white men with property. The problem was, of course, that they're the ones who are making war on the United States. So during the war, the Congress changes the definition of who should be a member of American society. And of course, first with the Emancipation Proclamation and then with the 13th Amendment of 1865, Congress passes and sends off to the states for ratification an amendment to the Constitution that says that America is going to outlaw racial slavery. Not all enslavement, by the way, but racial slavery in America, at least by statute, slavery by statute. Then it's going to go on after that in 1868, and it's going to pass the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And the 14th Amendment is so important. We just had the anniversary of the 14th on the 9th of July, because what the 14th does is it says that anybody who is born or naturalized in America is a citizen. And until 1875, that's going to mean as a citizen who has the ability to have a say in society. Generally, before the Civil War, the idea of citizenship was associated with the right to vote. So the Republicans dramatically expand the definition of who can be a member of American society, and therefore who has a say in American society. And they expand it in 1868, and then actually in 67 with the Military Reconstruction Act, and then in 1868 with the 14th, and then finally in 1870 with the 15th Amendment to the Constitution to say that Black men have a right to be citizens and they have a right to have a say in America, and the federal government is going to enforce that. That's one of the other things that's really stunning about the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments is for the first time in our history, they expand the power of the federal government rather than contracting the power of the federal government. If you think about the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, for example, they curtail the rights of the government or the abilities of the government. Those three expand what the federal government can do. But the Congress did something else during the Civil War, and that's that it invented our national taxation for the first time. That is, during the Civil War, we get our first national taxation. And it's the big set of taxation is actually called manufacturing taxes, which is not quite a sales tax. Really, it's a little bit different. But for our purposes today, let's call it a sales tax. And I'm sorry for all the tax lawyers whose heads just exploded. It's not a sales tax, but the point is that basically everybody is going to be paying some part of the manufacturing tax. But they also invented our income tax. In 1861, when they were trying to raise money for the war, the Republicans during the Civil War invent the American income tax. And then in 1862, they give us the precursor to the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. So they've set up this system where the people who get to have a say in society are a lot of new people who hadn't in the past. And for the first time in American history, they are going, their ability to have a say what the government is going to do is going to have a direct relationship to other people's pocketbooks. All right, so what happens then is that, of course, as you know, after the Civil War, white Southerners, white Southern Democrats don't want to expand rights for African Americans at all. And so they beginning in 1868 or so, to try and stop this expansion of who gets to have a say in society. And they start to try to terrorize their black neighbors into preventing them from going and voting for the new Southern state constitutions on the ballot in 1868. So they begin to terrorize African Americans in 1867 after the passage of the Military Reconstruction Act in March of that year. And then in 68, they continue to do so with the idea of making sure that the new Southern state constitutions that institutionalize the idea of black voting aren't going to be accepted. And that's where we get the rise of the KKK as a terrorist organization involved in politics. But in response to that, the Republicans in Congress go ahead and they do two things. First of all, they set up our Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is signed into law by Grant in 1870 with the idea that it is going to enforce, the federal government is going to enforce the laws on the books that the Southern states are refusing to recognize, and they're going to put down the KKK. So suddenly what has been a terrorist organization is on the losing end of federal power, and it goes underground. You're going to see the KKK is going to start to break apart in 1870, 1871 with a large number of arrests in the South and prosecutions in the South. And so what happens is that, recognizing now that attacking their black neighbors by virtue of on the issue of race is going to land them in prison, Southerners who want to stop the expansion of black rights begin in 1871 to use an entirely new argument. And what they start to do in 1871 is that they say, listen, we don't have any problem at all with African Americans, that's not the word they use, being equal. That's fine with us. We never had any problem with that. Our problem is that these African Americans who are voting, and who in South Carolina are a majority of the legislature, are poor. You know, they don't have anything. They used to work in the fields or in the kitchens, and they're poor, and they're voting for leaders who are promising them stuff, who are promising them roads and hospitals and schools. And how are you going to pay for those things? The only way you're going to pay for all these goodies, if you will, is by taxation, is through taxation. And by definition, because African Americans don't have anything, taxes are going to come out of the pockets of white people. So essentially, permitting black men to vote in 1871 is, in their argument, a way to redistribute wealth from white people to black people. That is, it is socialism. And they pick up that word socialism from the socialist movements of the 1840s and the 1850s, which have nothing at all to do with international socialism and international communism, which is going to rise about 30 years later. So Americans start to look at this argument, the idea that black people voting is a form of socialism or communism, and they take the word communism from the March through May 1871 Paris Commune, where workers in Paris, according to Americans, take over the city of Paris after the Franco-Prussian War and begin to run it in such a way that they confiscate wealth, and all society, according to Americans, just disintegrates, if you will. You know, women fill bottles with petroleum and stick rags in them and light them on fire and throw them into buildings. Well, if women are willing to do that, clearly society has gone to hell in a handbasket. So they begin to argue that permitting people of color to vote is a form of socialism or communism, and it is destroying American hard work, the values of hard work, of traditional working your way up. It's destroying the idea of doing things on your own, and instead it is asking the government to step in for you and to give you handouts, essentially. Now, I want to really emphasize that that is an ideological argument. It does not reflect reality, but it's an argument that hits the newspapers, not least in the South, because the people who are responsible for journalism after the Civil War overwhelmingly are former Confederates. So they keep telling these stories of African Americans who don't want to work, Black men who don't want to work, something that goes into our mythology in America from that period on, and that they are simply trying to have a handout. And literally, there are stories in big newspapers entitled things like socialism in South Carolina. Well, if that's the case, if in fact that Black voters are putting in office leaders who want to go ahead and give them stuff, you know, get elected by promising a new road or by promising a new courthouse or by promising orphanages are a big deal after the Civil War. Or here's another one that most people don't think about. And I know this is a rabbit hole, but I've always thought this was interesting. And I wish I had time to tell you the really interesting story about it. America after the Civil War becomes the world leader in prosthetics, because so many people have lost arms and legs and eyes is another big one. So, you know, the state governments are starting to offer to pay for people's, you know, prosthetics for their missing arms and legs. So if you're going to elect somebody who promises those things, that is going to require a redistribution of wealth from taxpayers to the beneficiaries of this. So what happens quickly after you've made that argument is the argument among white Southerners that African Americans who elect these people, and it's not just Black officials they're talking about, but officials elected by Black votes, they are corrupting the body politic. They are corrupting the government in the sense of corruption like a disease. So if you have a disease in the 19th century, your body is polluted. It is corrupted. And this is a corruption of the government, because what the government is supposed to do, according to this ideology, is basically just sort of clear the way for individuals to be able to work their way up. So the idea of the government actually doing things like building roads, all these things that the South desperately needs because it has not been investing, even at the state level, in these things before the Civil War the same way the North has, that is itself anti-American. Well, if that's the case in 1876, of course, the Democrats in the South argue that they are going to reclaim the South from this corruption and they are going to redeem it. That is, they are going to return government to the way it ought to be by getting rid of the Republicans who are still in office in the South. And they do so by, for example, holding rifle rallies on the outskirts of a Republican voting rally. They do so, of course, by terrorizing their neighbors and telling them not to show up. They do so by not letting them vote. They do so by making sure that way more Democrats vote than Republicans. And what happens is, in the election of 1876, as you know, the Democrats retake the final three Southern states that they had not taken before. And they do so on the argument, not that they are keeping Black people from voting, although that's exactly what they're doing, but on the idea that they are redeeming the government from these socialists or communists, from these people who are trying to steal tax dollars, if you will, and put that money into their own pockets through the ability now to go to school or to have roads at work, for example. And Southern mud, you probably all know stories about Southern mud. Roads are a really big deal in the South. So from that concern about the need to redeem the South, if you will, by 1876, the South has become, and people don't know it at the time, they're not going to really understand it until 1884, but by the election of 1880, it's going to be very clear that the South is going to vote Democratic. It's going to be a one-party state. All right, so why do we care about that? It becomes a one-party state in 1876, 1880. By 1884, the Republicans are very aware that the South is going to be a one-party state. But I mentioned this, and I wanted to call this out today, because we do, in fact, have a one-party state in the South between 1876 and 1965. And that's not to say that there aren't elections, I'm sorry, with the exception of Tennessee in 1920, if anybody's going, wait, Tennessee, 1920. Tennessee did vote for Harding in 1920, broke the solid South, but that was rare. 64, really. The solid South gets broken, but obviously it's broken by Goldwater. Anyway, the 1960s. Why does that matter? That matters because during those years, during those two generations of time in the South, there were elections in the South. people voted. But by keeping Black people and poor white people from being able to vote, the Southerners went ahead and were able to make sure, Southern Democrats were able to make sure that they retained control over the South. That even though they held elections, the reality was the Democrats were going to win the elections. Now, why do we care about that? We care about that, and what was the effect of that? The effect of that was that the South becomes, first of all, by far the poorest area of the country, by far. And the reason for that is that capital shuns a place that does not have political competition. And it does so for a very simple reason. And it's a reason that was very clear in the one-party South. The reason was that if there's only one party in charge of the government, first of all, there's no oversight because there's nobody who's going to call out their brother-in-law or their friend. There's nobody who's going to say, wait a minute, you guys are really corrupt. And one of the things that a two-party system does is it means there's always somebody watching. There's always somebody willing to call out the other side and say, wait, you're cheating on this, or wait, look at this guy. We need to do an investigation of this. I know it seems annoying when that happens, but that's one of the functions of a two-party government, is having somebody say, we're watching every minute, so keep your hands clean. And no party is ever clean. But you can see in places now that have had one-party government for a long time that has not had oversight, that you get these really horrific stories coming out. And you think, for example, what's happening right now in Florida with Matt Gaetz and Joel Greenberg. That's a party that felt like it could get away with anything. And for both parties, you want that oversight because little problems get taken care of and don't become big problems. That did not happen in the American South. So capital doesn't want to go in because, first of all, there's not going to be any a guarantee of a level playing field. It's a question of who you know, not a question of the law. And the other piece of that is, of course, that there really is, it really becomes a lawless area in the sense that people do not have equality before the law. Rather than saying, you know, everybody's going to be treated by the equally before the law. In fact, it's a question in the South in the 1920s, for example, the 1940s, of who you know. And one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is the civil rights movement that comes up in the middle of the 20th century was obviously about equal rights, for example, to the buses. But one of the reasons that Rosa Parks became an early spokesperson is because there was a large number of African Americans in the southern cities, led often by women, trying to push back on the extraordinary number of sexual assaults that were taking place in public areas by public white public figures, bus drivers, for example, that you simply couldn't get any kind of justice for because African Americans had no rights before the law. And of course, you see this immortalized in places like To Kill a Mockingbird. But so you have this, a one-party state is not solely about it's not solely about politics. It is intimately connected to the nature of that society, to the level of violence in that society, and to the movement of capital into it. Also, at the same time, after you get the rise of the one-party state in 1876, in order to justify that one-party state, increasingly Southern Democrats begin to talk about their Black neighbors as being dangerous to society as a whole. And by the second generation, they're no longer talking about that as a political thing the way they were before 1876, that African Americans are dangerous politically. After about 1889, when the Republicans try to reinstate Black voting in the South, this next generation of Southern Democrats begins to talk about Black voting as a danger to society in general, not simply voting, but also to society in general. And they begin to pull back on that old trope of African American men raping white women. And the connection between those two things is that because African American men, if they voted, would have access to jobs like being school superintendents, and because before 1883 in the Civil Service Act, people would get jobs based on who you know and based on the promise to vote for those people. And because women couldn't vote at the very time that they're starting to become teachers, for example, they would have to offer a different kind of inducement to get a job. And this, again, you can trace all through the newspapers. So by the end of the century, By the 1890s, as you're seeing increasingly this pulling back on Black voting, really notably in the 1890 Mississippi Constitution, which gives us grandfather clauses and gives us literacy clauses, you also see the rise in lynching. But there's a really different tone in the lynching in the late 19th and early 20th century compared to the KKK, because the KKK covered their faces, they operated at night. By the 1890s and the 1900s and the 1920s, lynchings are taking place in public, in daylight, and the people committing the lynchings are not covering their faces. More than that, they're taking pictures of themselves and sending postcards to their friends going, hey, look what I did today. Because purging the country of votes that are considered undesirable has become a civic duty. All right, so one of the points here that I'm trying to make is that we have in fact been in such a place where we've had a one-party state, and it's not simply history. It's a question of democracy and the need for a competitive system that has at least two active parties. All right, so you know where I'm going with this, right? How did we get to where we are today, where in fact almost a majority of today's Republican Party believes that states should be able to override the results of a popular vote of their citizens? So it's according to a study that was just published in The Economist a couple of days ago. And a supermajority of them have rejected the 2020 election and believe that the former president, Donald Trump, is still president. That's wrong, by the way. That's simply a lie. So how did we get here? We got here because I think we are replaying a pattern that looks very much like what happened in America after the Civil War. That is, after World War II, there is a move among Americans in general, Republicans and Democrats both, to go ahead after World War II and the extraordinary participation of so many different races, ethnicities, and genders to participate in World War II, and with the pressure of communist governments saying, hey, wait a minute, you keep talking about how great democracy is, look at how you're treating your people of color. There's a move in America to go ahead and expand the definition of who can be an American, and of course, to expand voting. In addition to that, we get the replay of the importance of the 14th Amendment. And that happens with the Republican Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren at first, who's appointed by Eisenhower and takes office in January of 1954. And one of the things that Eisenhower does, it's not his idea, but he certainly is one of the people to put it in part in the primary law of the land, is he uses the 14th Amendment in a new way. And what he does and what the Warren Court does is it reaches through the 14th Amendment, through the Due Process Clause and through the Equal Protection of the Laws Clause in the 14th Amendment, back to the original Bill of Rights, those first 10 amendments to the Constitution that give individuals rights in America and that hem in what the country can do, what the government can do. And it applies that 14th Amendment, it uses the 14th to apply those first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, to the states. And that's why we get the Brown versus Board of Education decision of 1954 that says that states cannot, that it's unconstitutional to segregate public schools. This is how we get the outlawing of housing covenants. This is that exclude minorities. This is how we get the overturning of intermarriage laws that say it's not legal for a white person to marry a Black person. All of this is because of the use of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that the states also have to abide by the rules that were imposed on the federal government. Immediately after that, of course, there's a massive pushback against the Warren Court and what opponents of it called legislating from the bench. And what they're arguing, of course, is that the states should be able to do anything they want. As long as voters in the states say they want segregated schools, that's just fine, because that's what democracy is. You get to vote. Except, of course, there's nothing accompanying that that says that everybody gets to vote. What they do is they simply say only white people can vote. And then they go, although they don't put it that way, it's, you know, grandfather clauses and all that, interpretation clauses, things like that. And then they say, but we voted so that only white people get to have a say. And this is true democracy, and the government should not be able to override that. And the Earl Warren's court, and then the Warren Burger court, Warren Burger being appointed to replace Warren by Richard Nixon, these are both Republican courts, go ahead and they say, no, we're going to use the 14th Amendment to expand who is welcome in American society. What happens, of course, is the pushback on that against people who are opposed to civil rights legislation and the business regulation that is inherent in that same argument and has also been established in the previous courts under FDR, begin to push back on that and begin to argue that, in fact, anybody who wants to use the federal government in such a way that it protects rights to schools, that it offers opportunity to people from different races or different genders, different abilities, that they are socialists, that they are redistributing wealth from people who have money to people who don't. And that rather than this being an attempt to honor the Declaration of Independence and the idea of equality before the law, in effect, what it does is to put, for example, troops at Little Rock High School in 1957, that costs tax dollars. So it's actually costing white people tax dollars to give black people rights. And therefore, according to places like William F. Buckley Jr.'s National Review, which he begins the year after Brown versus Board of Education, this is a redistribution of wealth. And he is going in that magazine to tell the violated businessman side of the story. But it's also, as he says, but it's also really pushed back against by segregationists and people who don't want to expand the definition of who should be an American. So what happens is beginning in 1986, when it is clear, of course, Reagan gets elected in 1980 on the promise to get rid of those welfare queens. And in 1986, when it becomes pretty clear that Americans don't really like the Reagan Revolution, Republicans begin to start talking about cutting back on who gets to vote. They start to talk about ballot integrity measures, but privately they write memos that say this should help us get rid of black people voting. That idea really takes off in 1993 after the Democrats push through Congress the Motor Voter Act, which expands voting, and Republicans begin to argue that they are losing elections, not because they're not popular, but rather because the Democrats are cheating. Once again, there's just no evidence of this at all. But in 1994, you get two very dramatic cases in the Senate and in the House where there are investigations all a year of elections that are alleged to be false and when enforced done by false ballots. And when those committees can't come up with anything, they simply go in front of the TV cameras and say, we know they cheated, but but they hid the evidence too well. And the idea that voter fraud is creating communism and socialism in America really begins to take off. And then finally, in the late 1990s in Miami, there is a Miami election, which is that there's not actually a Democrat running. It's an independent and Republican, both from the Cuban American community, and it's totally corrupt. Nobody has any doubts about that. And on the heels of that, the Florida legislature goes in and begins to argue for voter integrity and goes ahead and passes a law that results in about 100,000 people being thrown off the voting rolls of Florida before the 2000 election. That, of course, comes down to whether George W. Bush is elected or rather Al Gore Jr., the Democrat, is elected. And it eventually comes down to 537 votes in Florida. And, of course, had those numbers, those people still been able to vote, and most people think that Gore won that election anyway in Florida, that would have turned the trick. After that, you have increasingly seen not only the cutting back of Democratic voters in the country through voter suppression measures, which, as I say, are really going off the charts now since the 2020 election, but increasingly the argument that Democratic victories are illegitimate. And that argument that Democratic victories are illegitimate and therefore Democratic voters are illegitimate is one that I think is really on steroids right now with the increasing attempt in so many states to get rid of Democratic voting. Now, the place I wanted to leave this was twofold. One is that one of the reasons historians like me are pushing back so hard against any voter suppression measures and the attempt in so many of these Republican-dominated states to make their states one-party states is because we know what happened to the South. Without oversight of a viable second party, you're going to lose capital. You're going to end up with law that doesn't work equally for everybody. So nobody's going to want to move there. And you're going to end up becoming a very backward area. Companies aren't going to move in because they know that they're not going to be able to be treated fairly unless they know the judges, unless they know, unless they're connected to the power structure, that in fact, their companies are going to depend, if you will, on a mean tweet. And that's not something that is going to be conducive at all to bringing in money. It's also not a way to protect civil rights or to protect anybody's rights, because again, if you think about your worst stereotypes of, say, Mississippi in the 1920s, it really was a question of who you knew, not whether or not you had committed a crime. So we tend to look at that and say, this is a huge problem. This is not how democracy should work. We also look at what happened in America after the Mississippi Constitution of 1890 formally cut African Americans out of the vote, and then people had to justify why they had done that. And I don't want to go longer on that, but I really wanted to set up the reason that so many people like me have our hair on fire over the voter suppression measures is not because we are partisan Democrats, but because we have done this before in America. And we know exactly in those days where it went. And we would like very much not to do that again. Thank you. I hope that was useful. I'm going to turn this back over to Joe and answer the question, any questions that you might have.
Well, Heather, that was quite a tour de force journey from the middle of the 19th century to today. And you certainly showed the knowledge and the perspective and the realism that I mentioned when I introduced you. Let me begin where you did. And that has to do with the voting rights issues, your reference to voting officials, to the fear that a large number of voting officials have now expressed, and to the attribution by many of them of their difficulties to social media. And I bring this up because Facebook and other social media are in some stage of disrepute, at least among some people. You are very active, certainly on Facebook and on Twitter, Untold, because I'm not there, but you seem to have embraced those mediums. And my question is whether you could comment on how you believe Facebook and perhaps other social media have contributed to the political climate of disinformation that you mentioned at the outset.
Well, that's a great question, and it's why I am there. So it's worth pointing out that I am an idealist, and by that I don't mean I, you know, hunt ducks with a rake. I mean that I believe that ideas change society. And the reason that I'm on Facebook, not so much Twitter, because Twitter is they're very different media. I know people put them together, but they're actually very different. But the reason that I'm on Facebook is because there's so much disinformation there. And I believe that the way you change society is by changing the way people think about things. And the way people think about things is determined by what they hear and what they see. So, for example, my great example of this was after, in October of 2019, after the State Department issued its report on Hillary Clinton's use of emails. I read that report, and it basically said, you know, they did the same thing everybody else does, and, you know, we don't like some of the stuff they did, but it's pretty par for the course. There was nothing glaring here at all. So I wrote a letter about that, and the next day I got up, and every newspaper, and I basically said, there's no here, if you will. There's nothing here. And just reporting what was in it. And all the major news networks said, they slammed Clinton for this, they slammed Clinton for that. And I was like, oh my God, I misled all my readers. I must have made an error. I must have misread it. Now, it's worth knowing that I've read government reports for 30 years. This is really my wheelhouse. And I thought, really my wheelhouse. And I thought, I screwed up. I really screwed up. So I went back and reread the report. And it was exactly what I said. I had all the key quotes and everything else. The main media was wrong, but it was really illustrative for me because even me, who probably has read more congressional documents than virtually anybody except some of my historian friends and some of the people who work, for example, in the some of the congressional offices, even I listened to all the chatter around me and said, I'm wrong. My decisions were wrong. And that's exactly how Facebook works, is that if you see enough stuff coming at you, and of course, this is one of the problems with Facebook, especially Twitter to some degree, but Facebook especially, is that it's possible to weaponize that, which is exactly what's happened since at least 2015 in the country, where political campaigns and other campaigns as well can go ahead and flood the zone with excrement, as Steve Bannon said. They can flood the zone. So even if you don't believe what you're seeing, it's such a cesspool that you sort of throw up your hands and say, I'm just not going to get involved. I'm not going to pay attention to this because it's just too awful. And that is, I think, a really important political thing to recognize, that trying to throw crap everywhere is one of the things that has gotten us here, because it makes us stop having faith in democracy. So one of the things that's important in this moment, and you can see places like the Brennan Center have talked about this, the US government can't cut back on what is said in social media. What it can do, for example, is to stop bots, to stop fake accounts, and to make places like Facebook have an algorithm that doesn't privilege conservative voices the way it does now, which it does now. It's pretty clear. I don't mean that in a gut sense. I mean, Dan Bongino has the top 10 articles every day, and that's solely because he buys his way in. They can get rid of all that, and I think it's really important for that to happen.
Well, the growth of Facebook over the last 20 or 25 years has been phenomenal, and your response reminds me a little bit of why Willie Sutton robbed banks. He said it's because that's where the money is. And I suppose what you're saying is that you've got to fight fire with fire here, where people are paying attention, or your hair will be on fire, as it now is, which leads me to a follow-up question having to do with this recent 6-3 Brnovich case in the Supreme Court, which you mentioned. By the way, I checked. Amy Coney Barrett is not on the Forbes 50 over 50 list because she's 49. But as you know, she's one of the six. And what we now seem to be looking at is a court that first takes away the Voting Rights Act pre-clearance procedure for states who want to change their election laws. Thus, as you point out, 14 of them already have, and there's a slew of them still coming. And now in Brnovich, virtually guts the other operational part of that statute, Section 2, by upholding these restrictions in Arizona. And the dissent in that case by Justice Kagan stresses, as you do, the whole notion of democracy and where are we gone and where are we going? Well, my question now has to do specifically with the Supreme Court. Ever since right after the Civil War, we've had 9 justices. And everyone knows that if you elect Barack Obama, you will get a certain kind of justice, assuming McConnell allows it. If you elect Donald Trump, you're going to get another kind. But now we have President Biden creating a commission, and there's all of this talk about what to do. What are your thoughts on the subject of what to do about the Supreme Court?
Well, that's obviously a much longer question than we have time to answer. But that being said, There are some things that there are many ways in which our democracy is out of balance right now. And one of the things you just mentioned was the fact that we have had 9 members of the Supreme Court since 1869. And that was when we had 9 districts. And of course, we no longer have 9 districts. We have 12 districts, as I recall. I always do that number wrong and say 13, but I'm pretty sure it's 12. Am I right on that?
Yeah, well, 11 plus the District of Columbia plus the Federal Circuit, but you are, as usual, correct.
For some reason, I always want to say 13 on that one. Maybe it's a lucky number. Anyway, so there's good reason to go ahead and suggest that we need more people on the Supreme Court. I'm not making that call right now. There's a lot of stuff out there right now that people are talking about for the Supreme Court. There's also the issue of the fact that Supreme Court justices did not used to hang on until grim death. It used to be a job. And in fact, in the 19th century, actually, our first Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Jay, the space for John Marshall opened up. I don't know if you know this, but the space for John Marshall opened up because John Jay, the president tried to reappoint John Jay, and he's like, nah, I'd rather be governor of New York. It's a step up. So that's how we got John Marshall on the court. John Marshall was literally in the same room when he delivers the letter from Jay saying, no, thanks, I don't want this position again. And the president's like, who am I going to appoint? How about you? You look good. And that's how we get John Marshall. But I would say something different. One of the things, as you know, I do this podcast with Joanne Freeman, Dr. Joanne Freeman from Yale University. And she and I just did the Supreme Court. I think it was last week. I've kind of lost track. Actually, you know what? I'm not sure it's dropped yet. But anyway, one of the points that we make is that the Supreme Court currently is unusual, and it looks unusually like the Supreme Court did in the 1850s, and I would add the Fuller Court in the 1990s through the 1900s. And what makes those courts different than a court, for example, like the John Marshall Court or the Earl Warren Court, is that in the early days when the founders, when the framers came up with the idea of the Supreme Court, of course, they didn't have the idea of politics at that point. They didn't believe in political parties. And they tried to set up sort of a bank where you could go, a group of elders. They didn't have to be lawyers. They could be politicians, just people that were kind of the backstop so that some wise group would sit and think. And when the court has been at its best, that's what it's been, a wise group that sits and thinks. So the Warren Court, for example, Earl Warren is on the court because the court is entirely Democratic when he steps in because of all the years of FDR and then Truman. So Eisenhower makes it a real point to put in a Republican, but a consensus builder. So the Brown versus Board of Education decision is actually unanimous. There's an attempt to create that bank, that group of statespeople, if you will, who are trying to do what is best for the country. Now, when a political minority takes power and recognizes that it no longer has the votes it needs, it tends to turn to the Supreme Court as its backstop, and it begins to pack that court in such a way that it feels that even if it's going to lose power among voting, it's going to keep the Supreme Court. So, for example, you see Andrew Jackson going ahead and putting Roger Taney on the court. Now, Roger Taney on the court, who becomes the guy who comes out with the Dred Scott decision in 1857, Taney was such a partisan that he has to be appointed during a recess appointment as Secretary of the Treasury. And then when the Senate is supposed to confirm him, they refuse. He's the first member of a person appointed to the cabinet who doesn't actually get confirmation. And then he goes on Jackson has to appoint him twice, and he finally sneaks through as the leader, as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And then he goes ahead and hands down the Dred Scott decision in 1857, which is so partisan that the president of the country actually twists the arms of one of the northern members of the Supreme Court to go ahead and vote for it, even though the guy hates it because he doesn't want it to look partisan. But of course, it is partisan. It's a Democratic decision. And you see the same thing now, I think, where you had Edwin Meese who was Reagan's attorney general, literally saying he was going to solidify the Reagan revolution in the Department of Justice, in the court system, so that it was going to stay no matter what the voters did. And he's the one who begins to stop asking sort of what the jurisprudence of the lawyers being appointed is going to be, and instead literally saying, how do you stand on the issue of abortion? And you've seen that now to the point where we had, for example, Mitch McConnell blowing up the filibuster in order to get Neil Gorsuch through in place. Well, first of all, refusing to let Merrick Garland, who was known as being so bipartisan that even Orrin Hatch of Utah, who was a partisan Republican, if ever there was one, saying, yeah, I can live with Merrick Garland. But instead of putting Merrick Garland, who was expected to be even-handed on the court, Mitch McConnell, who was then Senate Majority Leader, said, now we're not even going to give him a hearing. And instead, we're going to get Neil Gorsuch. And when he couldn't get the votes for Neil Gorsuch, he blows up the filibuster. And eventually we end up down the road with Amy Coney Barrett, who didn't get a single Democratic vote. And that's pretty much unprecedented. So in addition to the fact that the Supreme Court and so many of our aspects of our democracy need to be modernized and need to grow up with the country, we also have the problem of the extraordinary polarization right now, especially among Republican senators. And that is something that, of course, ultimately should depend on the voters, which brings us back to the Voting Rights Act and to the minute we're in now. So my focus is less on the Supreme Court than on cleaning up the voting system to go ahead and then clean up the courts and get them back to this. And they were always political, but to the idea they were trying to do what was right for the country rather than keep a certain political party in power.
Well, let me just ask you one last question. And I begin by quoting Martin Luther King Jr., who said that the arc of history bends towards justice, often quoted. And you are an historian, and you have today and in your book and in your daily letters continuously given us a historical arc. You go back and then you come forward. But it seems to me, and I'd like you to comment on this, that today we are mired in both racial and economic inequality in this country. And I'm not sure that your comments today about how capitalism shuns places that don't have political competition is likely to be a complete answer or a quick enough answer to some of these problems. Well, which way does the arc of history seem to be bending in your view?
We have been in a place similar to where we are at least three times in the American past, in the 1850s, in the 1890s, and in the 1920s, all of which are times where the wealthy and powerful took over the country, took over Congress, organized the laws in such a way that the benefits of the economy flowed to them. And when they did so, they created enormous unrest among the vast majority of the people who were not served by the economy or the country the way it was. From those periods of unrest, in those three times, we got a dramatic expansion of the rights of the people and of the use of the government to go ahead and regulate business and provide a basic social safety net and promote infrastructure. And that would be the 1860s and 70s, the progressive era, and then the period after World War II. So my whole career has been about saying, here we go again. We know how this comes out. But the reason that I still write and the reason that I stay up at night a lot is because there's something new about where we are now. That is, we can see all the old patterns, and I can do, history doesn't ever repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. And I can sit here and say, here's how this happened, here's how this happened, here's how this happened in the past. But we're somewhere new. And that is that because of the Trump presidency and because of the period, especially after January 6th or after the election, which Donald Trump lost quite handily, more than 7 million votes, and by 306 to 232 in the Electoral College, the same margin by which he won in 2016. Since then, and his refusal to accept that, we've never had that in America. One party refusing to accept a loss. And now the vast majority of his party believing him when he says he won that election. And what we have now is something that really shocks me. And that is that the Republican Party leadership has jumped from the oligarchy that we saw in the 1850s, the 1890s, and the 1920s into authoritarianism. And they are now happily going ahead and following down this path that says one man should be in charge. And and they're cutting back the vote to make sure that happens. And how this particular moment comes out, I really can't give any guidance. We are standing on a knife edge. One side says we're going to repeat our history. The other side says we're in for a really rough ride for a while.
Well, my last question is there anything you would like to add?
I would like to add that everybody should go outside and enjoy this absolutely stunning day in July and enjoy themselves.
Well, that's good advice, Heather. And I want to thank you on behalf of everyone. I don't know the number of people, but I suspect it's a very large number who've been watching today, learning from you. It's wonderful to have you join the Lyceum this year, and we appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Next week, everyone, at the same time in the same place, the diplomat and historian Joseph Nye will be the Lyceum speaker. A good follow-up, certainly, to today's speaker and his topic, interesting subject, is do morals matter in foreign policy? So with that, I will thank you all for watching and listening and wish you a good week.